Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, welcome to another Rahulastepa Book Club. I'm delighted to be joined by Lee Hosey Pickett, who's written a fabulous book, a very important book as well, I think, called Up in Smoke, Stories from a Life on Fire. Hello, Lee.
How are you doing? You okay?
I'm very good.
Thank you for having me on.
No, it's my pleasure. I've really, really enjoyed the book. Now, you are a firefighter. So my first question to ask you is Hosey Pickett your real name, or is that a nickname that you've acquired over the years?
You couldn't make it up, could you? I I got my wife's surname is Hosey. She's okay. French. And she said, how do you fancy having my double barrel name? And I thought that would be fantastic. And it just didn't register the how humiliating that will eventually become at work.
Good. Well, I'm glad. I hoped it was, because it would be quite a bad nickname for a fireman.
Sure.
If that was, if that a firefighter, if that's the best you can, well, he's got a hose. We can call him a hose. He's good at the hose bit. Look, the book is, I loved it. It's entertaining. It's very funny, but it's obviously also very shocking. It's a real look into the life of a firefighter, which is obviously has absolutely horrific and horrible moments in it. Mm. And I found it very sensitively written as well.
Thank you.
I was foolishly driving my car whilst listening to the chapter about car crashes, but I found the story of the story you told about how you have to get in the car and hold hands with people who may be dying or certainly very injured. It was an incredibly moving story. I thought that one particularly. So it's, but there's a lot of humour in it. And as a comedian, I'm sort of interested in the way that what can be it's a mixture, because it's a very boring situation for a long time and then a very adrenaline filled and potentially scarring in mentally and physically experience. How important is humour in amongst firefighters, do you think? I mean, the book makes it clear it is, but
yeah, I think being in the job for as long as I've been, you often meet members of the public or friends of friends that aren't really aware of what it actually means to, or what it takes to be a firefighter, and you hear the same question over and over and again. How do you do your job? Now, how is that possible? You know, you must see some terrible things.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely correct. And if it wasn't for If it wasn't for the banter and the humour and the way that that enables firefighters to decompress from some very, very emotional and stressful situations, the job would be impossible. And you cannot, you know, there's a fine balance between laughing at something and laughing because you need to. Many people would say, isn't that slightly insensitive that you're laughing at death? And you think, well, when you're in that circle of intimate trust amongst your work colleagues and members of the public, especially those that may be related to the individuals that have passed away or been seriously injured, it's, you know, it's how we manage, it's how we cope. And it's an essential part of the job.
I mean, it's interesting. It is, you know, it's exact. I mean, I was going to say it's exactly the same as being a comedian, apart from that we don't save any lives or risk. Well, we slightly risk our lives by going on stage, but only from a bottle being thrown at us or whatever. But that philosophy towards comedy, you know, it sort of does feel. I would suspect everyone within their group of friends has something like that where they're able. You know, you're able to say. You know, I know that doctors talk about this, and obviously medical students are sort of renowned for the humorous way of getting through all of this. But if you, I mean, you describe in the book some very, you know, awful things that you have to witness. And obviously with fire, there's a whole extra level to this where there isn't, I can't think of a worse way to, you know, to die than being caught up in a fire. So if you're witnessing that, which most of us thankfully don't have to witness, making jokes about it has to be the only way. I presume there's a lot of jokes that didn't make it into the book that you do, which is probably a good
thing.
That's
book two.
But I find it interesting as well because it's I mean, you describe your first job where you didn't go out on any sort of serious calls for months, and so there's this job. If you're a professional firefighter, you're sitting around waiting for something to happen, and killing time and going to the gym, or you're saying you used to play snooker, there might have been snooker or whatever, you're doing. But so the practical jokes. I mean, I think that I'd find that the worst part of doing the job, to be honest. I'd be hoping there was a fire to get away from the practical jokes. But there are some very good. I mean, there are some very, very, very. Complex and well thought out and like so over the top practical jokes in there.
I've tried to add a balance, and it's it took a while to write, and that was because I wanted to get the balance of what it really takes to be a firefighter, the sort of characters and personalities that you find on fire stations. I wanted to educate people with fire safety messages and road safety messages within the funny stories as well. You know, I try and add that whilst you're having a laugh and at what you're reading, there's also a really important safety message in there as well. And I summarize that at the end. You know, those that read the book will see on the very last chapter, I bring together all of those. And I think I call that this book could save your life. And it can. It really can. There is obviously, I mean, we'll touch on the mental health side of things as well, but there's a huge personal sacrifice made by every firefighter in the UK and all around the world with the job and what it entails and what you see and what you take away from that. Because as a famous saying from one of my close colleagues who's a firefighter, Ricky Nuttall, he said, firefighters leave incidents, but incidents don't leave firefighters.
Yeah, of course. And I think, you know, that's what, because we don't think about that, you know. I mean, I would hope most people are very grateful that the fire service is there. Then you read this book and realise firefighters are living on the breadline, not getting paid properly, you know, not being paid for doing certain jobs that they do anyway. And it's sort of unbelievable that people wouldn't be, like, incredibly grateful and thinking, let's give these guys as much money as possible, just because you know, you can sometimes think with something like disability or something like that, or that kind of charity which I've worked with, I can sort of understand why people think, oh well, that'll never happen to me, even though it will. With a fire, you know, there's every chance that could happen.
Sure.
You want to know that if there's a fire in your house, that someone will be there in 5 minutes to get you out of it, you know. So it's incredible that people aren't, but I think to hear the story, and that's what's great, because again, I think it's a voice that maybe in the past in publishing we wouldn't have heard from. I mean, it's a working class story, and it's, you know, again, although I've had a few working class people on this podcast, it's not that working class voices don't get through into publishing too often.
No.
And when it just came to writing the book, before we talk about the job, which I do want to talk about more, were you approached to write this? Did you come up with the idea of writing this? And was it a difficult process to get it published?
So it was kind of a chance thing. You know, for many, many years, having come through three, you know, I'm a third generation firefighter in my family. My grandfather and my father would always say, you know, we, not just as a family, but firefighters generally have an incredible story to tell.
Yeah.
And knowing my lineage, my family lineage in the fire service is long and strong, I thought, you know, I have a story. My family has a story. You know, firefighters have a story, and not many get the opportunity. So for a long time, I was conscious of going down and the journey of writing something. And then just by chance, a guy called Jamie Coleman, who's my editor, who edited the book with me, he approached me on Twitter and said, I'm looking for a firefighter to write a book. And I was like, oh, well, funny you should approach me. And it was just this incredibly incredible journey of writing and getting editorial guidance from Jamie that we were able to publish this story. You know, it was very considered. Yeah. There was many, many drafts. I'm institutionalized in the fire brigade. I have no cross transferable skills, so writing a book was a very unique and different thing, but a journey I'm really grateful for being on.
Yeah, it's very well judged, I think, Lee, as well. It's, you know, it's not easy writing a book, even when it's autobiography, and you know, you're going, well, I'm just going to write what happened. I mean, there's so much more to get a life eventful as yours into a book anyway, but it's, you know, I think the juxtaposition of humor and more serious stuff, but it also makes you reevaluate reevaluate the stereotypes they might have of firefighters, which, you know, or firemen, I think a lot of people would still call you, and that's one of the stereotypes that's in, you know, that's embedded, and I'm still, I still kind of have to check myself not to do it. We've got a guy called Ian Stone coming on the book club in a few weeks, who's written a book about the 1970s, liking the Jam and liking football.
Yeah.
And the difference between then and now in masculine, in the terms of masculinity, which again isn't the only thing in firefighting, but is so huge. And again, I think what one of the remarkable things about this book, and one of the things that people might be surprised about, is how inclusive firefighting is now, and how that attitude of masculinity is so different now. The bottling it up and not talking about your feelings, and you know, and maybe having little different cliques of and not liking certain types of people, which we might associate with the olden days, I think, you know.
I'm grateful that I've seen a lot of that transition from having a white male dominated workforce when I joined the service in 1997, and how that's changed. You know, the fire service nationally were deemed sexist and racist because we had this dominance of white men. And there was a huge campaign by every fire and rescue service that set to change that, that situation. We've come a long way. There's still a long way to go. You know, I'm blessed to have worked with some incredible females who, in my dad and grandfather's, not so much my dad, because the transition had changed in the 80s, but certainly in my grandfather's era, you know, women in a fire station. the only position for a woman in a fire station was cleaning or cooking.
Yeah,
you know, back in the 50s and 60s. So you know, I'm grateful that that's changed, because for me as an officer in charge, as I point out in many chapters of the book, having a female firefighter on my watch, or a female or a male firefighter from a black and ethnic minority background in my disposal, in my workforce, when I go and deal with sensitive incidents that may involve women or members from the black and ethnic communities, I have this person that I can say, you know, can you go and speak to them? Because it instantly diffuses, it calms, mm-hmm. And there's that connectability between you and the service and the community that you're there to protect.
Sure.
And it's great that people can see themselves on fire engines now, or more of themselves on fire engines. You know, I'm sad that I'm at the tail end of my career when all this has really changed. It feels quite sad to think that in a not too distant future that I'll leave the fire service, but it'll be in a much healthier place.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, again, it's a bit like the comedy community as well, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit like everywhere. And I guess there's a reverse prejudice. And there's a sort of anti, you know, I guess a lot of working class people are firefighting. And so there's that prejudice that you're facing in return that you would be behaving in a certain way. And it's sort of, I mean, you know, just that story of you going into the car and having to be sensitive enough to talk to a guy, an old man, when his wife's passed away in the car beside him. And you know, obviously that's affecting you. That's obviously affecting him. And the sensitivity required, I mean, if you were just a brash, super strong man, and you are, I'm sure, a super strong man, then, you know, and didn't want to speak, then that would be an awful thing. But to be able to have the negotiation and the intellectual capacity to the emotional capacity, I guess, to talk to people in that situation is, to me, as impressive as running into a burning building. Absolutely. Which I have to tell you is very impressive. I'd rather talk to someone who's dying than run into a burning building, but I don't think I'd be good at it. So, you know, it's you know, I think that to see the sensitivity and the sensitivity you portray and the honesty with which you do it, I think is great as well, because you're not sort of saying, oh, things are fine, things are perfect. You acknowledge where things have gone right and where they've gone wrong. But I think, you know, I think you get so few books that are written from the perspective, you know, you might get a novel about a firefighter and probably isn't someone who's ever been in a fire engine, you know. Gone to a fire station and talked to a few guys or a few of the firefighters. So it's really impressive to get to hear from someone who, I think the fact you span those generations is partly what makes it great. But I think it's very reassuring as a man to feel that the men involved in this have moved on. And I love the camera, you know, that tight knit camaraderie between, you couldn't afford to be racist or sexist.
Absolutely not,
amongst your team, because those people might be saving your life at some point.
Yeah, for sure. You know, there are, as you can imagine, in any department or team, there are characters that rub characters up the other way. No, but not everybody gets on with everybody. But there's one incredible thing about firefighting and that industry and that career is that despite any friction or irritation that may be felt by individuals on a station when there's that downtime, when we get that fire call, regardless of what it is, that all gets put on a shelf, and we are all dependable, and any one of us would give our lives for our colleagues. And that's firefighting all over the world. You'll see that, as you've read in my book, and as people will read or hear, I test that theory when I go abroad. I'm always going into a fire station. My wife's like, oh, for fuck's sake, not another fire station visit. You know, I have to test that. And it is true. You are treated like a long returning family member. And it's incredible. And I don't know of many, I'm not going to say none, I don't know of many occupations that have that bond, whether it's domestically or internationally.
I think it's pretty unusual to be, you know, like you talk about going to New York and just popping into a fire station in New York and making friends with people based on the job. And I notice a little, again, amongst comedians, when you talk to other comedians, you drift in and out. You know, if I'm in a room with another comedian, it's like recognizing a dog, recognizing another dog. And you're quite comfortable with each other. But I don't think if I walked into a comedy club in New York, that everyone will go, hey, you're a comedian, come on in. I think they'll be a bit like, yeah, all right, mate, we're all comedians. So that's amazing. And I think, and again, I think, you know, I'll talk back to just the humor part for a second. The thing that I think it really brought home for me which is, again, I think things that people don't understand about comedy sometimes is it comedy can be, at its best, it's a uniting thing. So even though if you're taking the piss out, if you don't like each other, do like each other and you're taking the piss out of each other, it's a way to get closer together rather than to push people apart. So, and I think that's what's really clear from the humor in this. However, you could take something out of context and go, oh, how could you do that? How could you be that, how could you treat that? It's all the newbies being mocked and everything, but it's with love and it's with, this is what happens to everyone. This is, so in a sense, if someone came in and you didn't do it to them, that would be almost more offensive than doing it, because you'd be going, oh, there's some reason you can't do it.
That's where that's where, writing the book, I feared that there may be some aspects of the comedy that would be misconstrued or taken out of context.
Yeah.
And I think I've gone a long way to describing that humour and banter and that lightheartedness within the role of a firefighter and a watch is based on, trust and love and compassion and inclusivity. And like you say, if somebody wasn't in amongst that banter, then that's quite a difficult place to be. And I think from generations and generations of firefighters that come onto stations and come onto watches, there's almost this thing that goes on about like passed down banter. And we almost get people to understand that you shouldn't be too offended.
No.
Yeah. You shouldn't take light, you should be able to laugh at yourself or others in a very controlled way, because if you find banter offensive, when you go out and you see some of the terrible things that you're going to see, that's when you will truly know what offense is, because you do see some offending things that will stay with you forever.
Yeah.
And being able to have that trust and that decompression when you come back to station and somebody might say something completely inappropriate in relation to the job you've just been to, and it's almost so outrageous that you find yourself laughing but thinking, why am I laughing at that? But it's just the way we deal with things, and we're not insensitive. When we go out on a fire engine, we are 100% professional and we get the job done. And it isn't until we're in those confines of privacy that we are able to just do what we do. And I hope that people that read the book get an understanding of the importance of that, of the need for that. Sure. And almost say, do you know what? You deserve the right. You deserve to have a laugh.
Yeah. Well, I think, I just think you need that. And if people don't understand that, it just, as a comedian, if people don't understand, it's about context. It's about how you're doing stuff. It's about inclusivity and absolutely the need to, and obviously it only works to an extent. I mean, this book is very honest about, the mental strains. I thought, the physical strains would be worse. You talk about being, burnt in the face with battery acid and that sort of stuff. You think that would be the worst thing. And of course, there's, I think you look at a firefighter and think, oh, they're so brave and that, that this will all just, and you don't really think about what you all have to go through. And I think you talk about it being as a, over the course of a career, it's sort of filling up this, your capacity to be able to cope with all this. And a lot of firefighters, obviously, towards the end or at some point or at the beginning, find it too much to cope with. So
it's the accumulative effects of what we see over the course of a career. And it's very dependent on what exposure you've had to death up to that point of joining the fire service. Because if you've had zero, if you've never seen a dead person, that may affect you in some ways. It may affect others in more ways than it does some other people, but it isn't often a calm passed away person that we're viewing. It can be and is very horrific at times. And if you've had zero exposure to that as a new recruit, then it is very overwhelming. And we almost encourage a very light-hearted view on life, because at a moment's notice, it can all change very quickly.
Yeah. And you're also risking your own lives. As we've seen from countless international news stories, here and abroad, obviously 9/11 being the, you know, in firefighter terms being, and in every term being one of the worst things that's ever happened. But, you know, that's you every day having to cope with the possibility that you're going somewhere and you might not come back, which I guess you just have to tune out to some extent, but it must always be there.
Yeah. I think we're so highly, somebody said, I had a young girl come to the station with her mum on an open day, and she had some questions for me, and she said, could I ask you, the most serious question she asked was, are you ever afraid? And it was such a like, wow, what a powerful question. I pondered that for a moment and I said, do you know what? No, I'm not. And she was like, what? I said, no, I'm not. And I said, and I'll tell you why, because I've thought about it. We are so highly trained. We've got some incredible equipment and we have this incredible way of working that keeps us as safe as we possibly can be. And we trust one another. And when you put that, all those things together, you've got a pretty strong equation that kind of puts death and fear of death to one side, because there's so much trust there in everything that you have and do. So, you know, I firefighters do die. We have red memorial plaques now all around the country that are popping up and being placed in recognition of firefighters that have laid down their lives in service of their communities, which is incredible. And it's something that all firefighters that are in the job now appreciate, that acknowledgement of the sacrifice these individuals have made. It was a powerful question from her. I was like, I'm glad I pondered it. And I'm glad I kind of got in my own head why I'm not fearless, because I'd never thought about it before.
Yeah. I mean, but you do, I mean, you do have a lot of time to think in the job, I guess, as well, which is, you know, and that's, I think it's sort of so, it's such an unusual job in that just so much of it is waiting for something to happen. And especially if you're in a quiet fire station, that's a lot of months of almost, you know, you talk about almost wanting to go out on your first serious, because you've trained for this and, you know, without wanting, you know, thinking, I hope some people are going to die today. You know, so it's such an unusual job. And so I think, to be able to even cope with it in the short term, mentally speaking, is sort of incredible.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I was involved in one fire. I've been in where, and it's absolutely terrifying. And we were, it was when I was a student, when I was on Camp America, and we were in the Redwood Forest, basically in Northern California. So we were like 100 or 200 miles from the nearest fire station, I think. And the last night party, thankfully all the kids had gone home. There was a party and someone dropped a cigarette on the staircase, I think. And there was someone in this cabin, saw the fire going upstairs. Then the whole thing went up. It was right by where all the gas was. And there were we were woken up. I was pissed. You know, we just had this party. Woken up. I had to be shaken awake. And I was looking up the hill at these redwood trees just going up.
No, wow.
And, you know, and no, we had to try and deal with it ourselves to begin with by just taking big tubs of water up there. Absolutely. Uh-huh. I mean, if I hadn't been drunk, I think it would have been, there was no wind or anything that day. Luckily, there'd been a little bit of rain for the first time all summer night before. And I think that's, nobody got hurt. Someone nearly got run over, but no one got hurt. And the fire brigade arrived, but some of the tougher boys. I'd help load some water onto a truck, but absolutely just terrifying. And that was sort of, 50 meters away from the fire, I suppose. It didn't luckily spread through.
Right.
So it's, I can appreciate what you do to a tiny extent, just having experienced something like that, which I suppose a lot of people just haven't really necessarily experienced. It's something that it's one of those things you think won't happen to you.
And I was just about to say that every single week I will hear that phrase from someone, and it will be, I never thought that would happen to me. And that's why I make a really, really strong points in the book about planning for the fire in your home.
Yeah.
Don't be one of these people that says, I never thought it would happen to me, and lose, everything you know and own, or family members or pets. Have a plan of action. And, I give some really good advice in there on how to do that, and hope that once people, close that book up, they think, right, the first thing I'm going to do is test the smoke alarm and see if they work on every level. And if I haven't got any, go and bloody buy some, and have a plan. If we're woken up at 3 a.m. and the house is full of smoke, what do we do first? Don't become a statistic. And, I hope I've got the balance of that right. I think I have. I've had some great feedback from it. You've enjoyed it, and I'm proud of it. I'm very proud of it.
You should be very proud of it. I think just things like, that really got to me was the idea of tailgating an emergency vehicle, which you see happening all the time. And you think, doesn't matter, does it, if someone else is doing it? I don't think I've ever done it myself, but I might have done it if you're in a hurry. And you explain how distracting that is and how dangerous that is. And obviously you could crash into the back, but also it's distracting for the driver. And you do very amusingly tell a story where you lost your rag where you're able to get out.
That was an astonishing moment.
I could have seen that, but it's great. But I love that kind of, it's just it's the cumulative thing. And then you have the opportunity to just go to someone and go, what are you, and politely as, very politely, Lee, you go and, with some anger, ask this lady what she thinks.
Sure.
I think people wouldn't necessarily think about that. So I think things just like that really make you think, maybe do listen to it when you're driving, because it's sort of terrifying if you have the audio book, which you read brilliantly as well.
Thank you.
It does. I mean, it's scary. The scary thing about driving is, a lot of accidents can happen and they're not your fault, right? So, you just get crashed into by some other idiot. But again, I suppose it's reassuring to know, that you guys all know what you're doing in those circumstances, and how you can get in and often save people. Mm. Though I'm sure, is a car accident the kind of worst in terms of fatalities in your job?
In my experience, there's a balance there to be had, Richard. I've seen so many, but I think some of the most horrific things where you think, wow, can that actually happen to a human body, is at the result of careless driving, and drunk driving or drugs driving. It can be seriously distressing, and it should. I hope I'm quite vivid enough without being too graphic in sending that message through my book that don't drive like a dick, because you don't get a second chance.
No.
Sorry,
there's definitely some shocking things in there, but I think you have to put those. I mean, I'm sure you could have gone a lot further. I think you're talking about taking someone burning, taking their skin off their arm like it's a sleeve. Mm. That was the bit for me the most vivid bit. But yeah, obviously you talk about, some fatalities in car accidents where, again, a lot of things that you're not imagining can happen. You talk about this incident where someone ended up with a post right through their headrest that had just missed their head by an inch or something, and how close they came to, and they walked away fine. So it's those, You know, just one little thing. You can survive.
Ones.
Yeah,
the lucky
You know, luckily you can survive a lot of car accidents these days. But then you can just be unlucky in one way or another. But yeah, so it's you know, I think people do need to think about these things, and it is great. But I think there's so much going on in this book because there's enough funny stories that you can read it to just enjoy. Yeah. The camaraderie and the banter that would go on between working people. But there's all this advice, there's safety tips. I just think it's so important, especially for men. And I'm delighted that men are more open about talking and being honest about their emotions now. And I'm glad that firefighters are not thinking, you know, all those men who went to war in the 1940s, and 30s and came back and refused to talk to anyone about what they'd been through. And, you know, this, as a firefighter, you're essentially the closest to being in a war zone without anyone, hopefully, without anyone shooting at you.
No.
You know what I've been doing? I'm not going to rule it out. So to not talk about those experiences or to bottle them up or think it's, you know, manly or whatever, or impressive if you're a woman to not talk about it. I think men traditionally have been so bad about talking about these things that it heartens me to see that this is, it feels like something happening across the board that, you know, as much as you guys will take the piss out of each other, that equally if someone's struggling or in trouble, you're looking out for them as well.
As you've read, I'm very... It was a difficult chapter for me to write because I knew the journey that, excuse me, I knew the journey that I'd been on was a very difficult one. To have come through it and come out the other side, it's almost like you've dealt with it and you've put it in a box and, I'm okay now. But I felt with the opportunity to write this book that it wasn't a consideration in the beginning. You know, I just wanted to tell a side of a story of a firefighter that was more on the funny side.
Yeah.
But the more I wrote the book, the more I felt the need for the mental health aspect of it to almost sit. I didn't know where to put it, middle, end. I felt that it should go at the end because it's what people need to read and appreciate, whether that's members of the public that just need more of an appreciation of what firefighting can lead to, or firefighters that read the book that close the cover and go, do you know what? I'm fucked and I need help. And pursuing and almost seeing that if I could do it, then maybe they could. And that's, I felt very exposed and vulnerable in writing that, knowing that, I don't know, let's be hopeful. Millions of people were going to read it. that everyone knows that I've been broken and I am broken.
Yeah.
But I've come out of the other side and almost want to inspire others, whether they're in the job or not, to be honest and say, do you know what? If he can say, you know, if he can be, hold his hand up and say, I need help. I can't do this on my own. I thought I could, but actually I can't. I need a professional, whether that's a therapist or a, you know, just somebody to talk to. Taking that first step is the most important. Mm-hmm. And I go back to having female firefighters in the job as well. I think personally that has had a bearing on the softness of the job and having more softness in the form of female firefighters almost allows us to be softer as well. Mm-hmm. Because when you are in a dominant male workforce, there is this bullshit bravado and facade that firefighters, not so much now, but had like, I can't admit I'm broken because I'll get the piss taken out of me or I'll be taken off the run, which is our term for not being able to work operationally.
Yeah.
And the fear that may bring that they might even lose their job. I'm glad we're in a different realm. I'm glad that I'm able to have an influence with my book on a change of attitude. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think, it, you know, I think it's very easy for a member of the public just to think all of this washes over everyone, that you're just, you know, that firefighters just are brave and, you know, or thick-headed and it won't affect them. But, you know, it's sort of weird. It's, you know, it's being made to think about it. It's great just seeing how the job works. I know you, I mean, I was living in Shepherd's Bush when Grenfell happened. And okay. I slept through it, and it was, you know, it was very close to my house, really. And you were obviously there, and I don't want you to talk about this necessarily. I think I was so emotionally affected by what happened from that distance, even just having to see the building. Every time you would drive up the A40, you would just see the building, and that still haunts me. And, you know, seeing the smoke coming out of the building, but also seeing the blackened building for so long, and, you know, going down the next day trying to take stuff up to people. But you were, you know, you were there and experienced it. So
I just, I wasn't there. Sorry. I wasn't there. I'm not in London Fire Service.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I have very, very close friends that were there.
Oh, okay. What I've
done with writing the book is at the beginning, I made it, I thought, because of, I'm going to be talking about people and incidents, that I felt that I had to have as much disguise over where I work and where I'm from.
Right, okay.
And that's why, you know, that's why in the book I go to great lengths to try and protect people, places, organizations and things like that. And I talk about incidents like Grenfell and it would read like I was there, and I was mindful of making sure that that I shone a big light on that incident and what that actually means to firefighters that were there, because it's very important, because some of those men and women have been horrendously emotionally and mentally scarred for life. Sure. And I wanted to acknowledge them and them being there. So yeah, sorry if I've sort of led you to believe I was.
It doesn't change the point, which is, you know, that you've been through things that you know, even from a distance, would most people would go, oh my God, that's too much to cope with, and so you've been into those situations, and other firefighters, absolutely. So you know, it's an important point, and I think this book will really make people think about that. It's certainly made me think about it, as you know. But it is, it's a very readable book. It's a brilliantly written book, Lee. And I don't know how much writing you've done in the past, but you know, it's a difficult, you know, I'm a writer, and I've found writing books to be a very difficult thing to do, and especially a personal thing, and especially I think to be able to get across those emotive passages, you know, to actually move. I was properly moved by parts of this story, you know, because you absolutely put the reader into where you are. So I really recommend people to read it, because I think you, as you say, it could help you. It could help you stay alive.
Sure, absolutely.
But I think just in order to put yourself in the position of someone else and a story that you wouldn't necessarily always get, or certainly not from the horse's mouth. And so thank you very much for writing it, and thank you for being so honest about
it. Thank you very much, Richard.
You've got a quote from Russell Brand on the front. And you've been, do you meet him through working as, you've been working as a DJ?
I've known Russell since I was five.
Oh, have you?
The scallywag. And he's obviously been a massive fan of the Fire Brigade Union for a very long time. And we've done many, many things, outrageous things that I care not to discuss, the things he's got me involved in, politically. But, as soon as he found out that I was writing it, he said, "Lee, what can I do for you? Because I want to help you, and you know, I appreciate what you do and what firefighters do in general." And I gave him the book, and I said to him, "Just all I'd like you to do is read it and just give me an organic quote for the jacket." And he said he was more than happy. So thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure. And I just hope that, you said you've read it yourself and you've enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And that people are able to do the same. And, you know, the reason for writing it was simply for people that may not have had an idea of what firefighters do is to, you know, get the full picture.
Yeah.
And it isn't. And then, you know, when they see that red, you know, those red doors in their community, the fire station, they actually have an idea of who's behind them. Because like you said, people know firefighters exist, but it isn't until you need them that you truly understand their worth. And it's like an insurance policy. We all pay money for insurance for our cars or our homes. Firefighters are different. You pay your council tax. Part of your council tax goes to the fire service.
Yeah.
And they are essentially an insurance policy for that are there for when we need them in our worst moment.
And hopefully people, it will make people, I mean, it made me angry as well that you're not being appreciated as much as you should by certain members of the society, but also mainly by the government. Yeah. You know, the fact that,
yeah,
I mean, all this sort of cost cutting, you kind of think, what are you going to replace? Mm. If you pare stuff down like this, what the thing you replace it with, if you replace it, will be more expensive than what we're paying now. And
absolutely,
why aren't, you know, we absolutely should be in the position where guys like you, people like you are, you know, paid properly for what they're doing and comfortable and not having to go to food banks. You know, I think it's absolutely unbelievable.
The UK is the worst paid fire and rescue, you know, the worst firefighters are paid the worst in anywhere else in the world, in the UK. Yeah. You know, we're not held in the same regard as many other countries, which is very, very sad. You know, and we've got we've just been offered this derisory, insulting 2% pay offer, pay increase. And that's looking likely to go to a ballot for strike action across the winter, which nobody wants. But, 2% when inflation is so high is a real insult. And, firefighters deserve more.
They really do. And it just makes no sense. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things at the moment in the world that make no sense. And there's a lot of government decisions that make no sense. But it just, you know, it absolutely bamboozles me. So I hope the book will help people, will open people's eyes to that. And
thank you.
And also, you know, make the fire brigade irrelevant, and we won't, because we'll all have smoke alarms and there'll never be enough. No, there will always be. There'll always be fires, but we need people there to come and get us out. And, you know, and you make it very clear. I mean, I think that's the thing. If you have a fire in your home, you've got, you know, minutes, seconds to get out before, you know, so before the smoke gets to you. So that's why the smoke alarms are so important. Though mine keeps on going off when nothing's happening. That's what.
When was the last time you tested it?
I've tested it. It's in the circus. I'm going to get someone to look at it. The other day, it went off. A few years ago, it went off for about a few seconds and then stopped again. And it wasn't this battery, because there's a battery and the alarm.
Yeah,
I couldn't understand it. And then the other day, it just went off for about, you know, half a minute. I went around the house and looked for everything. And then it went. And then it stopped. And then it went off. I thought, this is going to get annoying. It wasn't the battery. It was going off, and then I hoovered it, and maybe it was dust.
Okay,
but I don't know.
That's a good idea.
It stopped. So just keep an eye on them and make sure they're at least it's working. I guess.
Yeah.
Even if it's malfunctioning, it's better to be woken up.
As long as it's making a noise.
Yeah, and when I cook bacon, it goes off. So I think we're that's my fire test. Look, really lovely to talk to you, and thank you so much for coming on this. And do go and buy Lee's book, everybody. I think we're back next week I think it's Marina Hyde next week. So I've already recorded loads that are coming out after this one. But there's some great people coming up, including Richard Ayoade's coming up soon. So do keep listening. Thank you very much. See you, Lee. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.